This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Before the United Kingdom could fully recover from the political shock of the yes vote to leave the European Union, another massive controversy has hit. The 2.6 million word report into Britain's role in the Iraq War was finally released after 7 years. Written by John Chilcott, the report is a damning indictment of former Prime Minister Tony Blair's role in joining the US in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. In between Brexit and the Chilcott report, a number of other things have happened. Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, widely considered one of the most progressive and popular political leaders in a while, has faced a serious attempt to oust him out of power after being accused of anti-Semitism. And Nigel Farage, leader of the ultra-right-wing UK Independence Party, who led the Leave campaign, has resigned. And of course, lest we forget, Prime Minister David Cameron announced his resignation immediately after the Brexit vote, saying he would step down in October. Joining us to try to help make sense of it all is my guest, Julian Mercier. He is a lecturer at University College in Dublin, Ireland, and the author of a number of books, including The Political Economy and Media Coverage of the European Economic Crisis, The Case of Ireland, Europe's Treasure Island, Deepening Neoliberalism, Austerity and Crisis, and Cruel Harvest, U.S. Intervention in the Afghan Drug Trade. Welcome to the program, Julian.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's first start with the Chilcott report. This was a report 7 years in the making. I mentioned 2.6 million words. This is a very, very detailed report. What do you think are the most damning aspects of this report? I understand that it went as far as to say that the war was unnecessary, but it didn't go as far as saying it was illegal, which is what, of course, would spark or could spark legal action, right?
Yeah, I mean, my view on the report is that the most damning aspect is more a symbolic aspect, that it can be said by the establishment itself that the war was wrong or conducted poorly and things like that. And just that is worth a lot because it hadn't been said enough before. But like you said, it's not exactly a very aggressive report. It's been reported as such, as a very aggressive report, but that's just by the standards of the media, which is not really used to say anything very aggressive against Tony Blair, let's say. So I think it's more a symbolic thing. There's nothing really that anybody who followed the Iraq War didn't know, unless you didn't have access to private conversations. That's okay, a bit more detail, like Tony Blair telling Bush that he will be with him whatever comes. So that's the quote that's been picked up a lot in the media. But I mean, we didn't need that to know that the war was immoral and illegal. And like you said, they don't even say the word illegal explicitly, even though what they say means that. So I think that's what it is. And it took, like you said, 7 years. I mean, it's very absurd that we had to wait 13 years to have a massive report that says just that, well, okay, mistakes were made and the war was, conducted on false pretexts. But still, it's very important because, we'll talk about it later, I suppose, with Corbyn, for example, it boosts a bit his leadership for things like that. It is important. And right now it's pretty much impossible to ignore the fact that the Iraq War was wrong, even though some MPs, members of parliament in Britain, were writing in newspapers today. I'd still vote the same way, pro-war. That was the right thing to do. So some people are never convinced by anything, but by and large, it's a positive thing for...
Now, did the report actually place the blame on intelligence agencies in the UK at all, in sort of implying that Tony Blair had misinformation or was just given the wrong information about, the so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or did it lay the blame primarily at Blair's feet?
Well, certainly Blair took a lot of blame from the report, saying that, he arranged things to make sure that it would build a case as best as it could be for the war, even though there was no intelligence. But also there's a lot of criticisms of military or intelligence for not preparing well and planning for the war and for... not being assertive enough maybe for intelligence information. But like I said, it's okay, but it's not very, very important, I would say, in terms of new information or anything like that.
How unpopular was the Iraq War when it was first launched in 2003? Sort of remind us, take us back to that time. How did ordinary people in the UK view, particularly Tony Blair's relationship with George W. Bush? Did they see the Iraq War as the UK rolling over and doing the US's bidding and being dragged into a war that they just were not wanting to go into because, Blair trusted Bush, etc.?
Yeah, well, I was in the UK at that time, but still, from what I mean, understand and I've been told is that yeah, there was big anti-war movement there, popular a bit like in the US, and there's this aspect, like you said, of doing the US bidding, which in the US you don't have that. You're confronting Bush directly, so a lot of comments on. Even in the mainstream press, like, should we not have a more autonomous relationship with the US and things like that? It's similar to what happened in America. People were opposed a lot, but the government didn't care. In Ireland, where I am, we had the biggest demonstrations in the world per capita. From what people say, I think it's true, but that's what the saying is. So not as big as in the US, but for the small population we have. So that was exactly the message. We shouldn't go along with the US, and Blair should resist that. And yeah.
Now, of course, the price being paid for that Iraq war continues to mount in terms of soldiers lost. Britain lost, I understand, a couple of hundred soldiers. The US lost a couple of thousand. Iraqis died in the hundreds of thousands. Some people even put that number as high as 1 million. And today, that chaos and violence continues. Many trace it to that initial invasion in Iraq. Can the Chilcot report have any bearing on UK policy and even European policy to an extent toward Iraq today? And also bearing in mind that the Brexit vote was in part based on people's fear of refugees, many of whom hail from Iraq, fleeing the Iraq war that the UK was involved in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know the impact that the report will have really, because again, a lot of that is really over, but it's not completely over. As you said, Iraq still with the Islamic State and all that, the consequences are still suffered to this day. I think for me, the main impact will be, like I said before, that from now on, it's more acceptable, even in the establishment, to say that it was wrong, it was poorly conducted. Just one more layer of making it acceptable as a conclusion. And I mean, I don't think politicians are in the business of really, modifying their actions unless there's really a lot of pressure. So maybe that will lead to that. Maybe Corbyn, for example, other anti-war voices will be empowered and will be given more time or space in the media to drive the message home. Maybe that will change things. Maybe it will affect anti-immigration feelings in the UK by showing that, once again, government people are not really to be trusted often. But that remains to be seen, really.
Yeah. And it also remains to be seen if the US will ever get its version of the Chilcot report, given that it was the US that led the war, that provided the main impetus for going into Iraq and continues to remain there today. Let's talk about some of the internal politics in the UK, particularly post-Brexit. We've been talking or bringing up in passing Jeremy Corbyn. He's a leader of the Labour Party, widely considered. This is sort of an approximation, but the Bernie Sanders of UK, if you will, except he's the leader of the Labour Party. There was a crisis, and that's the word that many in the media used, around charges of anti-Semitism that Jeremy Corbyn and even the Labour Party as a whole faced. Some have linked that to the reason why he has been, there's a pressure to oust him from the leadership of the Labour Party. First, let's talk about the anti-Semitism charge. Is there any truth to that? Some say that this has been wholly manufactured.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I haven't read too much on that, but what I've seen is that some members made comments, and it's not as bad as in the US, where as soon as you talk about Israel, it's really like a big red flag, but it's still the same in the UK. And that's what I mean. It's not, there was one this week, and then there was another issue a few weeks ago, and I mean, it's all, it has nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn, right? Whatever was said, that's not the problem. The problem is there's people, the Labour Party in the UK is split between a Blairite wing, more right wing, following Tony Blair. And now Jeremy Corbyn came as a kind of a big surprise even to them. And they're not happy with that. And that's as simple as that. And they'll take whatever means is necessary
Right.
to.
And does any of that have to do with Jeremy Corbyn's position? And I should add, Corbyn himself says he has Jewish ancestry. Does it have anything to do with his position in supporting the boycott movement against Israel?
Well, that's one aspect of his progressive politics, and there's many more. For example, while we were talking about the Iraq War, he opposed it since the beginning. And if you look at the leaders of the attempted coup, who they are, Angela Eagle, Hillary Benn, and all those people, there's five or six main ones. If you look at their record, they all supported the Iraq War, for example. They all supported the renewal of Trident, which is the nuclear force of the UK. They all refused to oppose a big austerity bill that was passed last year. So they're very conservative for Labour, or they're almost, in the left of the left wing of the Conservative Party. And Jeremy Corbyn came as a surprise because they put them there. They put him there as a candidate last year to make it look a bit more interesting as a race to the leadership. But then people started joining the party in huge numbers, and then he won. So it wasn't expected on the part of the establishment in the Labour Party. And for the same reason as Bernie Sanders is not well liked by the establishment Democrats. It's the
And
same issue.
meanwhile, of course, the public often feels like they are hearing what they want to hear from figures like Corbyn and Sanders, that these progressive figures, when they speak clearly of their progressive values, the public flocks to them because it seems as though many countries' populations are tending more left than the media and the establishment would give them credit for. So you were mentioning the Chilcot report might give Corbyn some backing, some political backing to kind of stand his ground and say, look, I was right, because this huge report basically confirms the position I was taking. Do you think that he can weather this storm? Is his position some There's some in the media saying that the coup attempt against him within the Labour Party is essentially going to be failing.
Yeah, I think he will survive. That's my feeling. And I mean, if he doesn't, it's really because that will mean that the Chilcot report has zero impact. Because if anybody wanted something clear, like I said before, the leaders of the coup all supported the Iraq War. I mean, we're not even talking about Afghanistan here. We're talking about the Iraq War, which was, I mean, anybody knew that it was completely wrong and ridiculous to go there, but they still supported it. And not only that, but after that, in 2004, 5, 6, the leaders of the coup refused to establish a commission of inquiry like the one we finally got with Chilcot. They didn't want their own actions to be investigated because they knew that it would make them look really bad. And Corbyn always supported that. So that's very, I mean, it's black and white. So, we can always argue maybe on austerity or something like that. But the Iraq War is an easy case. So it can only help him. And if you look at the polls of popularity that he has, it's very, very impressive. Before last month, there was a poll taken among Labour voters and asking who would you vote for in a leadership race, Jeremy Corbyn and others. The ones that are cha he got about 60-70% of support, and the ones that are challenging him, Hillary Benn, Angela Eagle, they got about 2 or 3% each. I mean, it's really laughable. It's not as if they were even close. So he's for the reasons you gave, it reflects more people's interests, and people are happy to hear that, the same way as Bernie Sanders in the US.
Let's turn to the spate of resignations within the UK political class that have been happening. This is kind of hard for us here in the United States to understand politicians resigning. It doesn't quite happen in the US. You could have a politician facing some of the, you know, worst scandals, and they will dig their heels in and try to, you know, keep power. But in the UK, not only did David Cameron, the Prime Minister, announce his resignation the day after the Brexit vote, but he said he would actually step down later in the year. But now Nigel Farage, who presumably won his battle to have Britain exit the EU, he has stepped down from the leadership of the UK Independence Party, this ultra-right-wing party. What's going on here?
Well, Cameron is easy. He organized the whole referendum, he lost it. So that just means that if he cannot win on a big issue that he put his stamp on, it's a vote of non-confidence from people, so he had to resign. That's easy.
And that just sort of is part of the intricacies of the UK political system, just because of the way in which parties are elected rather than individuals. In the US, you could have something similar happen and a politician wouldn't resign. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he could have stayed and say, oh, well, I missed it, I made a mistake, but I'll carry on. But I think he would have a lot of pressure to resign, but there's no automatic rule, but he resigned. It was a big issue. Then the race was open for a new leader for the Conservative Party, and because Brexit had won, nobody really had a plan for Brexit. It's like if they were campaigning just for the present and not really caring about the future. And that made it more chaotic. So now you wonder who's going to lead the party. Well, you need someone for sure who is kind of in favor of Brexit to some extent. Otherwise, it would be telling the whole population, well, we don't care too explicitly what you think. And on the other hand, the establishment still wants someone who is not a crazy Brexit person, because the establishment in the UK is in favor of remaining in the EU. So they didn't get what they wanted with the vote. So you need a candidate that's filling those boxes, someone who is willing to detach the UK somewhat, but not too much. And then a lot of people can come up with their plan for that, and it became really chaotic, and Boris Johnson lost support, then Michael Gove lost support.
And Boris Johnson was a Conservative Party leader who led the charge against Brexit in opposition to Cameron, who was voting to remain.
Yeah, Boris Johnson and Farage that you mentioned, they're a bit like Donald Trump's. They're really populist right-wing, especially Farage. And then Farage, as you said, he won. He was on the winning side, and so you would have thought that he would have all good reasons to stay there and strengthen his position and maybe, you know, grow his party or whatever. He's in the UKIP party. He's not in the Conservative Party, but he resigned quite dramatically. And if you read the media, nobody was talking about why he resigned, because there didn't seem to be an obvious reason. People were talking more about the consequences. The reasons, who knows? Farage resigned last year, and then he unresigned a few days after. So maybe he will come back. Who knows?
Wait, he unresigned?
Yeah, he resigned, and then his...
Is that like Britain voting to leave the EU and then kind of regretting it?
Well, exactly. It can be something like that. Yeah. So people were saying, well, okay, has he really gone or not? We don't know. Another reason is maybe because he wants to leave UKIP to lead a popular movement for the same goals, but in a, kind of a better reform new party, perhaps, or just a popular movement for the moment. And maybe he just wants to go back to, you know, business or something like that. So who knows why? I haven't seen any convincing explanation or even explanation of why, you know, something that would be really explaining his departure. But that's what he did. So it just adds to the kind of surprise element. Nobody really knows what he's doing. Maybe he just didn't want to lead the charge, because again, the establishment is against Brexit. So maybe he thought, if I lead it too much, I'll make no friends and I won't be able to keep going.
Well, it certainly remains to be seen what plays out in the next weeks and months. I want to thank you so much for helping to shed light on what's happening across the Atlantic. Thank you so much, Julian.
Thank you.
Julian Marcel is my guest. He's a lecturer at the University College Dublin in Dublin, Ireland, and the author of a number of books, including The Political Economy and Media Coverage of the European Economic Crisis, The Case of Ireland, Europe's Treasure Island, Deepening Neoliberalism, Austerity and Crisis, and Cruel Harvest, U.S. Intervention in the Afghan Drug Trade. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.